BFY, LP 100.9, Belfast, Maine.
Welcome to Books and Writers, a show for writers, aspiring writers, and those fascinated by writing. I'm your host, Spencer Stevens. On Books and Writers, we'll talk with those who know writing is both an art and science, who know how to make writing work, how to get it noticed, how to find inspiration, how to avoid ruts, and how to get out of them. We'll discuss the habits, habitats, and brains of writers, editors, publicists, bookstore owners, publishers, and others. We'll talk about the books that should have succeeded but didn't, about the writers who ignored the rules and succeeded anyway. We'll look at works in progress. We'll lead you to being a better writer, or at least to a deeper appreciation of your favorite writers. Our show begins after these words. Our show today features an interview with poet, writer, and playwright Linda DeWitt, who has been working in Belfast this summer on completion of her new play, Our Time. Linda will tell us about her methods, her plans, and about details of her new play. Also, we interview Nancy Housewald of Belfast's Left Bank Books. Nancy tells us about the best new books by Maine writers. Stay tuned.
Belfast Community Radio would like to thank Searsport Veterinary Hospital for their support of the station. Located at 322 West Main Street in Searsport, they offer pet exams, vaccinations, radiography, surgery, dental cleaning, and pharmacy. They can be reached at their website, searsportvet.com, or 548-2924.
Hello, I'm Vic Treadwell, and it's my pleasure to bring you a mix of acoustic music from all over as the String Band Lunch. The program features one three-song set of local music right at the bottom of the hour. Hear the String Band Lunch weekdays at noon here on WBFY.
Today, we're with Linda DeWitt. She is a poet, writer, and playwright who lives part of the year here in Belfast, part of the year in Bethesda, Maryland. And Linda has an interesting career and interesting history and an interesting project to tell us about. I want to explore that with you, Linda. Let's start out with your interest in writing and where that began. Tell us about what age you were and what the circumstances were when you first pursued your interest in writing.
Well, thanks for inviting me here, Spencer. This is fun. I started writing early on in grade school. I started a newspaper in my neighborhood called The Friendly Informer. That name came from a book I read, whose name I can't remember any longer. But I put it together with some neighborhood friends, and we went around reporting, asking our neighbors what was new. So Mrs. Green got new carpeting, and Mrs. Smith had a baby, and that sort of thing. And we had recipes and coloring pages, so that was great fun. I kind of let that all go until graduate school. I did go to AU, American University in Washington, for a master's degree in journalism. And after that, I was a writer and editor for several decades for various organizations, mostly nonprofits, National Geographic Society and Discovery, Smithsonian, the Audubon Naturalist Society in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And People, Places, and Plants. Some of your listeners may remember that publication in Maine about 20 years ago. It was extremely popular, and we started, the publishers of that, Paul Tukey among them, started a edition, the People, Places, and Plants of the Mid-Atlantic, and tapped me to edit that. So I worked with them for several years. So
was that was your, as far as freelance assignments or jobs go, that was your last professional experience, the People, Places, and Plants?
No, after that I worked for I worked for the Audubon. That was my last official gig. Mm-hmm. And I retired from all of that in 2013. when I started another business, which is totally unrelated to writing, so we won't get into that. But since my retirement from the Audubon Naturalist Society, I've been working on this play, and I've written some poetry and moved from nonfiction to fiction, which was quite difficult, actually. Nonfiction, I felt like I could do all day. I knew how to research, and I knew how to create an outline and put that together pretty easily. Fiction, it's all you in your head. So that was challenging, but I wanted to pursue that.
In the days when you were active professionally as a writer, did you think about poetry and fiction and plays, or did that come after?
I did poetry and some short story writing on my own during my career. This last project of a play just came to me like a bolt of lightning, if you will. The story just seemed perfect for a play. I'd never written a play. I loved going to the theater. I loved live theater. So I just tried it. And but it was difficult, extremely difficult, and I guess.
So the play project you're working on now, tell me the title of it so we have a reference point.
The title is Our Time.
Okay. And you began writing Our Time how long ago?
About 6 years ago, about 2014, I started it.
Okay. And the project is not quite done yet. Is that correct?
It's not quite done in that it's never been on stage. I finished writing it to the point where I felt it was where it needed to be. And I think you'd agree where writers are always their harshest critic. And I didn't like it until one day I did. And that day it was largely done. I've had two readings of the play since then, and each time I edited it quite a bit after those readings. So the process is not over with the rewriting and the polishing, but by and large, after 6 years of working on it with some long breaks, it's finished.
The folks who are listening, a lot of them are writers or aspiring writers, and I want to explore some of the nuts and bolts about how the process has gone, any obstacles you encountered, how you overcame them. Tell me about the format. I mean, why a play instead of a novel or a short story or something else?
I can't say exactly why, except that it seemed right to me. The story involves covers a span of about 40 years, and it's about female friendship and how politics are personal. It was too much to put into a poem, and I can't really explain it more than that. I just heard their voices, and the dialogue in a play is dominant. In a novel, I guess I would have to write so much more descriptive prose to fill in, and I just didn't see that. I just saw the dialogue, so it was always a play in my mind. With, you know, I had ideas for the sets that needed to be done, but beyond that, I don't know why.
It felt right. And it sounds like your idea for expressing what the thoughts and ideas you had was all about dialogue, and that led you to going towards a play instead of some other form. Mm-hmm. Am I reading that part correctly?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And had you attempted a play before ever, or just your first one?
First one.
Okay. And so the process has been about 6 or 7 years so far, mm-hmm. and let's talk about the story. You've got three characters and you follow them from, I've read the play, and my recollection is that you start following the characters sometime when they're relatively young college kids, and you follow them at intervals going up to late in life when they're experiencing issues and problems related to age.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from? Was that biographical or pure fiction?
Part of it is biographical. I am in touch with college friends. We get together every year. There's seven of us who get together, and I guess these three characters are a combination of all of us. None of us have lived an exciting life that was worth writing about. So there's a lot of fiction in here, but the spirit of the time and the spirit of the relationships I used to write the play. So it's semi-autobiographical. And my college friends have read it, and they see the similarities and of the times and of their lives. But I will say it didn't just flow. And I know you want to get into some of that. It was, you know, very challenging. I've never written anything that wasn't difficult to do. The first draft is the hardest, getting those bad words on paper first, and then you just sculpt it and sculpt it and sculpt it. I started out with five characters. You know, they were all doing different things. I had five or six different ways to begin the play. You know, it was just going over and over and over it. And I think I mentioned to you, too, there was almost 2 years where I didn't even work on it. I was just fed up and gave up.
The process you described, where you were evaluating options, changing the number of characters, trying to figure out where to start, things like that, were you working solo completely, or did you have input from other folks who were maybe following along and reading your work?
I took a writing workshop, actually up here in Maine, over a weekend, and I talked it over with the teacher there, and I was telling the class about it, so I got a lot of good feedback from the other students and from the teacher, and the teacher and I stayed in touch, and I sent her descriptions of the characters until she felt that they were shaped well enough. And she read an early draft as well. So I had her input, and I also belonged to a writer's group, and they were very helpful. It's good to have people who also write, who are non-judgmental, and, you know, who just want everyone to be successful and enjoy the process. So many of the women in the writers group work for a living, and they're writing for publications. But there's a few of us who are doing so-called creative writing, and so they were an inspiration too.
So you would take pieces of your play and give them to your writers group and get comments from them?
I did that with, I shared with one of the women in the group who asked to see more. But I would just talk it over during our monthly meetings. We'd all share what we were working on, and I would talk it over, some issue I had or problem. And, you know, they were very helpful.
So many writers I talk to, present company included, find it very useful to get time in every single day or almost every day in their writing. Did you find yourself in that kind of a pattern when you were working on the play?
Yes, but it took blood, sweat, and tears to get there. Again, I fought it. I fought this project. One part of me just felt I couldn't do it. Another part of me wouldn't let it go. And as I said, I stopped working on it for close to 2 years. And then I decided, I think I had a dream, actually, which is so weird. It kind of was like a dam breaking. The play was done, and in this dream, and I woke up not feeling blocked or stressed at all. And that day, I decided to work on it every day, just like you were saying, an hour a day. And good, bad, whatever happened during that hour, I was just going to devote my, give it 1 hour a day. And 1 hour often became two or three. And I just didn't have pressure on me. I just worked on it. And then one day, it was done. It was a miracle.
Did you have any sort of a system for the time of day? Did you work in the mornings, in the evening, or just whenever you were able to find the time?
Whenever I found the time, you know, the earlier in the day is less cluttered. As the day goes on, it seems like there's more and more things that get in the way. So, you know, usually between 8 and 3, I'd say.
Early in the middle part of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And did you find it difficult to carve the time out? Were other things competing for your time that you had to fend off?
Yes, but mostly it was just distractions that, with discipline, I could control. So, you know, I had retired, and I didn't have young kids at home or grandkids, so, you know, I was running a small business. You know, there were things that I could have let get in the way, but I just made up my mind to devote an hour, and then it became easier once I made up my mind.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I think for most folks, committing to a project, it takes several years, requires you to make it a priority, and making it a priority means it has to be important to you for some reason. Some people have a message they want to give out. Some people just feel a need to structure themselves and to record ideas and thoughts. I'm curious if you have anything along those lines that you would call a touchstone or a force that pushed you forward.
That's interesting. I think I would say it's almost an anti-force. What I kept coming back to was the fear that I wouldn't do this. What if I didn't do it? That this was a story I wanted to tell and no one else was going to tell it. And what if I didn't do it? And that was very disappointing to think about. So that drove me to do it because I didn't want to not do it, if that makes sense.
Sure. Lots of us have projects that we don't want to not do. That gets us across the finish line.
Yeah.
So you're working every day on your play, or almost every day, and how far into the project did you get before you began to receive some sort of positive feedback?
After I finished, I set up a reading with some actors. And
after you finished a first draft?
Yeah, after I finished and I felt like it was finished. I liked it. This was fall of 2020. And I set up a Zoom with some actors out in California that I know of. And so we had a reading over Zoom. And I got a lot of positive feedback from that, from the actors, and also from the half a dozen people who were on the Zoom call just listening. So that was heartening. But again, I was able to make some cuts and changes. It was too long. It's still probably a little too long. So I've been shortening lines, taking out any fat at all, taking out a few scenes to try to get it down to a manageable length, which, you know, what's manageable? Everyone's got a different opinion on this. Some people say the trend in plays now is 90 minutes, no intermission. My play is 2 hours, so I think of it as 1 hour intermission and then another hour. But it's if I cut out, you know, 10 or 15 more minutes, I think it would be good, but mm-hmm. I don't know if I can do that.
That's tough, taking out stuff.
Tougher, though, to me, is adding stuff. So I was an editor for a long time, and I'm pretty good at cutting stuff out. So I'm getting it down to the bone.
Very good. Tell me about your plans for the play. Like, where do you see this going? Is this something that you hope will get produced and will be a hit on Broadway, or do you have something more modest in mind?
More modest, I'd say. I see it, you know, in a small to medium-sized playhouse, and how to do that is tricky. With playhouses being closed for more than a year, there's a lot of backlog of plays that are, and playwrights that want to get their work produced. So, you know, it's not the perfect time to be pitching, but I plan to do just that. I will send it out to artistic directors at playhouses here in Maine, and see if I get any nibbles. I'd like to, you know, I'd definitely like to get it produced and, you know, on stage. So that will be another learning curve. But I, you know, I had another reading here in Belfast a couple weeks ago with some talented local actors, and I got some valuable feedback from that experience, and I hope to make some other contacts and send this out and work with the Playhouse to get it on stage.
Having written fiction and having worked on trying to get books published, I'm familiar with the process of looking for agents, looking for publishers, going through the editing process in that context, a novel. And I know that the traditional process is you send your manuscript to an agent, hopefully they like it, they shop it around to publishers, hopefully they like it and they buy it and they publish it for you. Is there a parallel process that's considered the gold standard or the typical way for getting a play produced or published, or is it more varied?
I I'm going to find out how the process works. I've been told I can send it out to artistic directors at playhouses, and I have sent it out to one or two already, with no replies. So I don't think an agent is required, but the more I, you know, go into this process, the more I'll learn. Hopefully you can have me back on in 6 months or a year, and I can tell you more about that process.
I would like that very much. Tell me, I attended the reading you mentioned within the last week at the UU Church, the United...
Unitarian. Universalist,
thank you.
Yeah.
And I watched the actors go through the lines, and I read along in the manuscript as they did. And I'm wondering what takeaways you had from that process. What things did you learn that you didn't think you were going to learn, and how have you changed the play as a result?
I learned that the actors' cues that I had written in there, like said with frustration, said with sarcasm, sighs, pauses, those kinds of actors' cues are not useful and are usually tossed out by actors and directors. So I was able to cut those out. I also saw some ways I could make the characters a little more distinct. So I made some editing changes on some of the lines. And I also was able to cut out a few pages of dialogue that I thought didn't move the story forward, or that were redundant. So it was useful in that way.
Yeah. As I saw the play, as I read it, it looked to me like a story without one protagonist. The three friends seem to feature equally in the plot, equally in the quantity of time and attention that the viewer or reader would see. I'm wondering if that was a conscious decision or did it just happen unconsciously because of how you viewed your material.
I was fairly conscious. I saw the actors, the roles, as co-equals. I feel that one of the characters changed more than the other two by the end. But that they were equals, and they all had very different lives and different experiences. But yeah, you're right. It was, as you've said, an ensemble cast, and not. There is a slight more dominant. One of the ones is slightly more dominant. She has more lines. And she's just a more forceful personality. But basically, it's an ensemble, right?
I'm curious, have you gone to other playwrights for any ideas or inspiration or criticism?
Yeah, I have. Margaret Engel is a playwright in Washington, D.C. Oh, gosh. She wrote the play
You can't think of the name at the moment. That's okay.
She's written a couple plays that were not on Broadway, but on big stages in Washington, D.C. And I got some good feedback from her. I was very generous. And then another actor in Washington, who's done a lot of acting, read it, and you know, they're both very generous with their time and with their feedback, so I was able to glean a lot from both.
Some of the best input and criticism that a writer can get is by somebody who's accomplished in their field, but I think most of us will acknowledge that can be a difficult something to get. A prominent or successful writer probably has a lot of folks demanding or wanting their time and has to pick and choose how they want to divide their attention. Was it difficult to get Margaret Engel to read your play? Was that a challenge?
No, she was a friend of a woman in my writer's group. So, you know, my friend in my writer's group made the email introductions, and she was very happy to do it. She, you know, she said everybody in that industry is generous, and she's been helped by older women who came before her, and she was more than happy to work with a new playwright. So, you know, it was lovely, actually.
The friend of a friend avenue worked for you. That's a great way to go, I've always thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your play, Our Time, is this when you're done with it? Are you done with writing plays and fiction, or do you have ideas or plans for continuing down that road?
No plans, but I don't rule anything out. I am carrying this project to its, you know, destination, and then we'll see what comes next. I don't know.
If a young playwright came to you and said, you know, I have an idea for a play, I want to try to write it and put it together, do you have any thoughts or advice you might share with them off the top of your head?
I don't feel in a position to do that. I would suggest the software that I use, which is called Final Draft. It's a real handy piece of software for playwriting. You know, good writing, there are certain things that all good writing share. So I would, you know, maybe talk about that, but beyond that, I'm just learning myself, so I couldn't really offer too much guidance.
It sounds, though, like you've made a substantial investment of your time and your attention on this. You've made an emotional investment. I get the impression that you're happy you did it. It's been a good thing for you. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. Absolutely. I'm so pleased to have done it. And truthfully, if nothing becomes of it, if it's never put on stage, my work is done. I mean, I can only control the writing process. I can push to get it on stage, but I can't put it on stage. I don't own a playhouse. So, I feel very good having completed the play to my satisfaction.
The play is Our Time. The playwright is Linda DeWitt, who's been our guest today. Linda, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time and sharing with us so much of your thoughts about your experience putting the play together. I hope you'll be sure to let us know if the play gets produced. We'd like to come see it and maybe interview you again when that happens.
This has been fun, Spencer. My pleasure. Thanks.
Support for Belfast Community Radio comes from our listeners and from the Colonial Theater, showing the best of Hollywood, world, and independent films online at colonialtheater.com.
For the second segment of today's edition of Books and Writers, we'll talk with Nancy Housewald of Left Bank Books in Belfast, Maine. I'm with today Nancy Housewald from Left Bank Books in downtown Belfast, Maine. And we're going to talk about books for the season, new and exciting books by Maine authors. And Nancy, tell us a little bit about the first one you would like to talk about.
Okay. Well, I have they're in no particular order. I have five of them here, and they broke down into two novels, two nonfiction books, and one mystery. And they share in common the fact that they are all written by, as you mentioned, Maine authors, and they are all relatively new. The oldest was published maybe about 6 months ago, but other than that, and some were published as recently as 2 weeks ago, but they're all current bestsellers.
Excellent. Okay.
And in no particular order, I'll just read the titles and then we'll tackle them.
Sure.
The Mystery is Dead by Dawn, by Camden writer Paul Dwyron. The two novels are Landslide by Portland author Susan Conley, and The Lowering Days by nearby Portland author Gregory Brown. And the two nonfiction books are The Field House by Robin Clifford Wood, who lives in Bangor, and the newest book is Down East, with a subtitle, Five Maine Girls and the Unseen Story of Rural America. And that's by a writer by the name of Gigi George, who splits her time between, I think it's New York and Southwest Harbor.
Wonderful. Okay. Repeat, if you would, please, the name of the book by Gregory Brown.
It's called The Lowering Days. It's L-O-W-E-R-I-N-G.
Excellent. Okay. Let's start wherever you want. Which one would you like to talk about first?
Well, let's just start with the mystery, since that sort of stands by itself.
Sure.
So, the title is Dead by Dawn. It was released about 3 weeks, I think 3 weeks ago tomorrow. And the author is Paul Dwyron. His name is mispronounced as many times as it's pronounced.
I'm sure.
Paul has a fabulous website, one of the finest author websites around, and he has a whole page devoted to the origin of his name and how many ways it's been pronounced and some of the funny stories he's encountered from having a difficult to pronounce last name. But Paul was he was at one point the editor-in-chief of Down East magazine, and he has now released the 12th book in a wildly popular mystery series. Every book takes place in Maine in different seasons. Paul himself is a registered Maine guide, so there's a lot of nature, in his series. And as an aside, Paul's wife is an accomplished poet by the name of Kristen Lindquist. And Kristen is a very accomplished birder. And so you'll see a lot of references to birds in Maine in Paul's book. So they're very richly layered. The entire series features a male protagonist by the name of Mike Bowditch. And Mike is a Maine game warden who gets into one major scrape in every story. And this particular one, Dead by Dawn, I love one of the reviewers who said that this series just keeps getting better, although Bowditch is going to need some serious body parts replacements if he keeps right. Which is just absolutely right. This particular book, I think, is maybe his best yet, and it's just wonderful to see writers taking risks with their work. And what Paul has done in this particular book, and I'm not giving away any secrets, the entire book is set on the day of the December, the winter solstice, obviously the shortest day of the year, and Paul has crafted this book so that the entire narrative are all of the action takes place in one day, in that one day.
Very curious arrangement. That's good.
Yeah, it's very, very compelling. So that's Publishers Weekly calls it the best yet in a superior series, and I couldn't agree more. Once people start with Paul's books, they become completely hooked. They really become enamored. It isn't totally necessary to start with book number one, which is The Poacher's Son. It's always good if you can, you know, if you think you're going to be interested in a series. But I started his books sort of around book four or five and didn't have any trouble catching up. And then I went back and started at the beginning.
I'll confess, I met Paul at Left Bank Books when he was there for his book launch. And we had a nice chat and I bought a copy of it, which I've not yet started, but I'm feeling an urge to pick it up and open it now.
I read it in about 36 hours. The classic, I couldn't put it down.
A page turner.
Yeah, it
Excellent.
Really is.
Okay. Yeah. And let's talk about Landslide by Susan Conley, which is also in the fiction category. Tell us about that.
Yes. So Susan is a fourth generation Mainer who lives in Portland. She's written a fabulous memoir and about three or four other novels. This one, I think, another Maine author by the name of Lily King wrote that with this book, though, Susan has knocked it out of the park, and I think that's absolutely right. This particular book was a New York Times editor's choice. Jenna Bush on the Today Show selected it as a summer read. It was acclaimed as a best book by Good Morning America. It was a Maine NPR's book club pick of the month. So it's very, very good. Susan is also, she's an incredibly skilled writer, just from a technique point of view. She teaches on the Stone Coast MFA faculty at the University of Southern Maine.
Sure.
So she's very good. She has, she can tell a terrific story, and she tells it with consummate skill.
Tell us about the plot. What's the book about, and where does it go?
So this takes place somewhere, I'm guessing, mid-coast Maine or southern Maine, in a small fishing village. And the protagonist is a woman by the name of Jill, who's the mother of two teenage boys. As she refers to them as the wolves. And Jill's husband is a lobster fisherman, and right at the opening of the story, we learn that he's been severely injured in an accident at sea, an engine explosion on his boat, and he's airlifted to Canada for recovery. So suddenly Jill finds herself as a single mother with these two teenagers who are grappling with the age-old problems of teenage boys, sex, drugs, and school, while she is, of course, profoundly worried about the fate of her husband, which evolves into the fate of their marriage, this separation, this forced separation, gives Jill time to reflect on who she is as a woman, as a mother, as a wife. And so that's basically, it's a story of really the values of a family in crisis, and it's all set against the state's declining fishing, declining fishing opportunities. The economics of fishing, as we know here, are changing rapidly.
It sounds like the kind of a story that most of us could relate to, given its strong connection to family and home.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's, it's very smart, it's honest, and it really takes a fresh look at at family, at the the complexity of families. And I think given what we've all been through in the past year and a half or so, it's a particularly, especially timely book, as we've all spent, well, many of us have spent a lot more time with our families in the last year and a half.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, let's talk about Gregory Brown's book.
So this is Gregory Brown. It's really interesting. He grew up here in Belfast. He's a graduate of Belfast Area High School. He now lives just outside of Portland. And this is his debut novel. I'll get to the plot in a moment, but I think when people come into the bookstore and look at it and wonder what it's about, I simply tell them that Richard Russo has said that no first-time novelist has a right to write a book this good. I think that's pretty high praise from a Pulitzer Prize-winning author.
I'd say so. That's pretty excellent.
Yeah. So this is I've actually read this twice. It's so lush in terms of language and setting. It takes place, it's also takes place in Maine. It's in a fictional town, I'm thinking somewhere around Bucksport or Belfast. And it's the story of a town that is on the brink of economic collapse because their sole largest employer was a paper mill, and that has closed. It seems like all the options for work for the residents of this town are just about zero when a Japanese investor comes calling. And there's a lot of hope that the mill will reopen. However, not everyone is wanting the mill to reopen because of the pollution. It's because of the environmental impact of the mill. And I'm not giving away any secrets when I tell you that right in the opening, a teenage girl from the Penobscot Nation tribe sets fire to the plant and burns it down. And that sets an entire sequence of events in motion because some people in town call it criminal mischief, and others are calling it environmental justice. And it sets loose a series of long simmering grievances, and it tears the community and the two main families in the story apart. It's a mesmerizing book. Greg is so in tune with nature. He has even said that as a child, you know, he was always outdoor. He loved exploring the world beneath the world. And this book is really a testament to, I think, to his love of the land and the love of place. It's really a sweeping story. It's got it all. Family dynamics, as I mentioned, environmental issues, economic despair, the complex relationship between indigenous people and white settlers.
Wow. I can't wait to pick that one up. That sounds excellent.
Yeah, it's really good.
And let's talk about the field house. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, two nonfiction. The field house. Oh, my, I love this book. The subtitle is A Writer's Life Lost and Found on an Island in Maine. And this has the most interesting backstory. The book is actually a hybrid biography and memoir. It's a biography of a writer who is sadly not well known at all anymore. Her name is Rachel Field, and she was a Newbery Medal-winning children's writer. Her two most famous books were Hitty, Her First 100 Years, that was published in 1929, and Calico Bush, 1932. And Rachel was a nationally known poet and playwright and a rising success in Hollywood in the early 1900s. I'm sorry, in the early part of the 20th century. And she died God, so tragically, at the age of 47 in 1942, and she was really coming into her own. So this is the story of Rachel's life. The reason that Robin was compelled to write it is, I can't remember now, quite a few years ago, she and her husband bought a summer house, an abandoned summer house on Sutton Island up in the Cranberry Isles.
Sure.
That was Rachel Field's summer home for, I should know this, maybe a dozen years or so. And Robin didn't know that. Robin and her husband didn't know that when they bought it. And Robin became totally engrossed in the life of this woman whose house she was inhabiting. And there were even all kinds of artifacts from Rachel's life that were there in the house, to a collection of ceramic Scotty dogs, because Rachel was enamored of Scotties, to Life magazines that had her mailing address on them, to tea towels she brought back and collected around the country. So Robin, she spent almost 10 years crisscrossing the country, going to Rachel's homes, to the schools she attended, finding, first-person resources. And she's written this sort of parallel book about her discovery of the woman while she's discovering the woman's house.
What a wonderful idea for a book. The stories of writers' lives so often make for great books in themselves, and this one in particular sounds like it really fits the bill. I'm excited about that one very much.
It's fabulous. Oh, because I don't know when this is going to air, but just so you know, Spencer, actually Robin is going to be on 207 in the interview by Rob Caldwell tonight.
Oh, is that right? Tonight being the Monday the 12th of July. This episode will have aired by after that, but maybe they'll archive at the 207 program.
You can find anything online.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So that's the Field House, and the last one is the most. Well, this was published about 2 months or so ago. So this is Down East, and again the subtitle is Five Main Girls and the Unseen Story of Rural America. This is a very, very interesting story that really needs to be told. Gigi is a writer and an academic, a professional journalist. She was a former administration official in the Clinton White House. And she splits her time, as I mentioned, between New Hampshire and Southwest Harbor. And she has become intrigued by the people, she became intrigued by the people who were living in Washington County because of its geographic and economic isolation. And it's interesting to her that Washington County, is just an hour's drive from Bar Harbor and Acadia, and it's an entire world apart. So she, over the course of 4 years, between 2016 and 2020, she basically, not lived with, but she traveled with, went to school with, worked with, interviewed five teenage girls, all of whom were at the name of the high school, Narragansett High School. And she tracked their lives from entering high school through graduation. And it's a unique story and a very nuanced, I think, portrait of rural America, with the twist being that it's about women and the power of women to survive, the power of women. Down East women have to be strong women. And the subtext here is that Gigi writes about how strongly these women are torn between their homes in Washington County and discovering the world. And that's sort of what she traces, these five girls who struggle between wanting to get the heck out of Dodge because she has an abusive father. Then we have one girl who is a star softball player who's gotten all kinds of offers to go to school, but she wants to see the world, but her passion is captaining her own fishing boat at home. Then there's another girl who is recruited by Bates for their basketball team, and she just spent a year there and decided she really wanted to switch majors and go back to school at the University of Maine so she could be closer to home and help the young people coming up in her hometown. So it's really interesting to follow these women from their local stories to venturing out in the world. One girl becomes valedictorian and goes to, is given practically a full scholarship to Yale. So they really, it flies in the face of what a lot of reporting says about the poverty, the low educational goals, of rural America. And she sort of, Gigi sort of turns all of that on its head by taking a microscope to the lives in the community and the families of these five young girls.
That sounds like a very rich and revealing book. Mm-hmm. I am again intrigued. I can see myself picking up all five of these and digging in as soon as time permits.
Each is its own, and that's one of the joys of book selling. You can put the wrong book in the wrong hands at the wrong time of someone. Not everybody wants to read about the problems of rural America sitting on a beach in July. They want a good mystery, so it's important to balance where you are physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually when you choose a book.
So is this an especially rich collection of Maine books we are looking at this year, or is this common? I mean, are Maine authors just that good?
I wouldn't say that five of them come out within such a short period of time that are so strong is maybe a little unusual. But, we're just blessed with, my gosh, the roster of writers here in Maine is so impressive. It's just so impressive. I think we're just very lucky that people here in Maine cherish their writers, cherish their bookstores, cherish good stories, these were five easy ones to pull off the shelf. We have, there are dozens more that have come out since January by Maine authors.
Sure. Well, a number of the authors you've mentioned today I've met at your bookstore, and you're correct. The Maine authors are a tremendously talented bunch, and it's always a joy to have the chance to come over to Left Bank Books and hear them talk and shake their hand and chit-chat. It's a real opportunity. It certainly is.
We're really looking forward to having in-person events again. We're tiptoeing back into making that happen. We have to be very careful, of course.
And yes.
But it's starting to happen. It'll be different from packing people standing room only in the past. That's not going to happen for quite some time. But with some social distancing and some safety precautions, we're looking forward to having author talks again.
Wonderful. Well, a lot of us are looking forward to that, and myself in particular. Nancy Housewald from Left Bank Books, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. For anybody who's catching up in the middle of this program, Nancy has given us five excellent new books by Maine authors that are easily worth checking out this summer. Nancy, thank you again.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure. I enjoyed it, Spencer. Thank you.